advance on the ground. Iran's foreign ministry also condemned the killings in southern Syria, with ministry spokesperson saying the resistance of Syrian youth against Israeli assailants is a natural and legitimate response to the act of aggression. Ismail Baghaei also slammed the inaction of the UN Security Council in the face of Israeli violations against the sovereignty and territorial integrity of regional countries, including Syria and Lebanon. Earlier, Hamas and Islamic Jihad, as well as Qatar, separately condemned the raid on the Syrian town of Beit Jin. And Syrian civilians injured in Israeli force attack on Beit Jin were then transferred to a Damascus hospital for treatment. Let's listen to what some had to say about the ordeal they witnessed.
Israeli forces attempted to detain men from the village, but residents resisted and clashes erupted. The troops pulled back, but returned with airstrikes and heavy shelling. They bombed several homes and the mosque. Some lost their lives and others got injured.
At 3 in the morning, Israeli forces stormed our village, trying to seize one of the young men. We resisted, and there were dead and wounded. At 6 a.m., after they withdrew from Beit Jin, we moved toward a damaged vehicle, and they opened fire on us. Then came the airstrikes, planes, artillery, rockets. I was hit by artillery fire and got injured. This wasn't the first time. 4 or 5 months ago, they took 7 men from our village. So now, whenever they come, we resist. After pulling back, they returned with planes and rockets, striking the village. They attacked from the air with heavy machine guns, helicopters, drones, mortars, raining fire on us.
We opened fire at the Israeli patrol to defend ourselves and prevent them from arresting us. My brother was martyred, and I got injured.
The hospital has received 16 wounded. 5 members of one family arrived dead. Earlier, 11 injured were brought in, among them a woman who did not survive. 2 patients remain in critical condition and are now in operation room.
And we were earlier joined by journalist Robert Fantina. He says the Israeli violations against regional countries, including Syria, are all part of a plot to occupy more territory amid international silence.
What we continue to see Israel doing is trying to expand its own territory in violation of international law, certainly, which says that territory can't be gained through conquest. So we're seeing this country, the Zionist regime, which is always saying it's the victim, bombing yet another country, bombing and killing innocent people, innocent men, women, and children. Several children were killed in this. Homes were bombed. What is the strategic reason for bombing homes, private residences? There isn't any. It's simply the fact that the Israeli regime, the Zionist regime, wants to clear out anybody who is living in a territory that it wants. The fact that this is yet another instance of Israeli violation of international law is just appalling. When is the world government, is the world community going to say this is enough? This must stop. We see what's happening in Lebanon and in Palestine, both in Gaza and the West Bank. Now, Syria, this is a rogue nation that is completely out of control, and it needs to be reined in.
As well as Secretary General Sheikh Naim Qassem has condemned Israel for the assassination of Haitham Ali Tabtabai, vowing resistance will retaliate.
The expression and the stance which I am announcing against the martyrdom of the Mahdi Sayyid Abu Ali, may God bless him and his comrades, this is a blatant aggression and a clear crime, and it is our right to respond, and we will determine the time for this.
Speaking at a memorial for the late commander, Sheikh Qassem, so the regional American intelligence provide the Israeli regime with the information that allows it to operate comfortably in Lebanese territory. He said the ceasefire is a victory for resistance, adding Israel failed to eliminate the resistance and then thus had to agree to an arrangement. Naim Qassem stressed the Lebanese state is responsible to ensure Israel's withdrawal and then deploy the army in the south. Hezbollah leaders said the resistance weapons liberated Lebanon after decades of occupation and remain the only deterrence power against Israel's expansionist plans. He said U.S. and Israel are trying to strip Lebanon of its defensive capability, indicating the real threat lies in Israeli expansionism and not Hezbollah's arms. Now, the Gaza ceasefire agreement has not stopped Israel from launching attacks against the Palestinian territory. The regime's military has killed over 350 Palestinians since the truce took effect. And let's cross over now to our correspondent in Deir el-Balah, Ghada Ibrahim, for your latest on the ground out of Gaza. Ghada, good to check in with you. Hope you're safe and doing well out there in central Gaza this morning. What more do you have to add to our update for ours?
Yes, as you know and as you mentioned before, the Israeli violations of the U.S. brokered ceasefire agreement are continuous, and this actually comes in the form of the Israeli attacks that are ravaging the eastern parts of the Gaza Strip from the north to the south. In the south of the Strip, we have very heavy airstrikes and artillery shelling targeting the eastern parts of Rafah and also the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City. The latest of these attacks resulted in two Palestinian children killed. Both of them were children and both of them were brothers in the eastern parts of Benisheila area. Again, these attacks are ravaging the eastern parts of Gaza City and the eastern parts of Khan Yunis City on a daily basis and around the hour. We have also heavy airstrikes and heavy artillery shelling on the eastern parts of Gaza City, like Ash-Sha'af and At-Tufah neighborhoods in the north of the Strip. And also we have more airstrikes in the eastern parts of Beit Lahia and Jabalia refugee camp in the north of the Strip. These attacks are continuously causing more bloodshed among the Palestinians since the beginning of the ceasefire. Until now, we have at least 350 Palestinians killed, more than 900 Palestinians were injured, and this number is increasing every passing day because of the continuation of these attacks and because these attacks are violent and are causing not only more damage but also more bloodshed among the most devastated population here in the Gaza Strip. Most of these attacks happen to be behind the so-called yellow line in areas that are completely under the Israeli control and under the Israeli firepower. However, more attacks are also taking place on the western parts of the Gaza Strip. We have warships opening fire towards the coastline of Gaza City and Al-Mawasi area in the western parts of the Strip that are actually inflicting more injuries and causing more injuries among the displaced people who are ramming along the coastline of the Gaza Strip. And let me speed up on the latest from UNICEF, that UNICEF report that actually indicates that at least 9,300 Palestinian children under the age of 5 are diagnosed with acute severe malnutrition since the start of October until this moment. This again highlights how these Palestinians are living unimaginable catastrophic humanitarian situations even after the ceasefire went into effect, and that highlights how most of the population cannot have access to food and to the proper medication in order to alleviate the suffering of these Palestinians even after the ceasefire went into effect, highlighting again how the Israeli occupation army is not allowing enough amounts of food and medications into the Gaza Strip. These lives of the children are at stake nowadays, and most of the people are nowadays suffering because of the lack of food items and because of the lack of medications. At least 16,000 Palestinian patients are nowadays waiting to be medically evacuated outside the Gaza Strip in Gaza hospitals, lacking all the basics of survival, lacking food and lacking medications and medical supplies here in the hospitals of Gaza City and in the Gaza Strip.
Thank you, Ghada, for that update. Stay safe and talk to you soon. Ghada Ibrahim joining us from central Gaza. Meanwhile, the United Nations says violence by Israeli forces and settlers in occupied West Bank has surged over the past 2 years, leaving over 1,000 Palestinians dead. It says there's almost been zero accountability.
Our office has verified that since the 7th of October 2023 and up until the 27th of November this year, Israeli forces and settlers killed 1,030 Palestinians in the occupied West Bank, including East Jerusalem. Among these victims were 223 children.
Hello, welcome to the press briefing.
Lawrence also cited recent disturbing incident in city of Jenin, where Israeli occupation forces were filmed, shooting dead two Palestinian men trying to surrender. The UN has already called for an independent, prompt, and effective probe into Israeli killing of the Palestinians, and then for those responsible to be held fully accountable. Hundreds of Israeli soldiers, backed by the armored vehicles, have recently carried out sweeping raids across the occupied West Bank. This is the largest military deployment since last month's ceasefire in Gaza. And joining us earlier with your update, Occupy West Bank was a Ramallah correspondent, Naka Ahmed.
Let me start by some news from the ground on the fourth day of the military aggression. The five pillars in in the northern part of the occupied West Bank, precisely in Tubas, where the Israeli soldiers the Israeli forces last night have withdrawn from the village of Tammun and from Al-Far'a refugee camp. And by withdrawn, we mean that they have withdrawn from inside these places, not leave it and raise the military sanction over these areas, Aqaba, Tayasir, and Tubas, throughout the night, have faced many aggressions and many attacks. 29 Palestinians have been abducted from inside Al-Far'a refugee camp, fieldly interrogated, and many of them were assaulted. 27 have been beaten severely. The Israeli forces continues to affirm that the entire Tubas province is a closed military zone. Nablus was also under attack throughout the night. In Jenin, the situation is also tense.
And staying with the occupied West Bank, residents of the village of Tammun, they're in occupied territories, have been recounting their ordeal. Let's have a listen.
They punched me and beat me with their feet all over my body. Then they unleashed the dog on me, and it bit me several times. Then they brought my brother into the shower and brought the dog in with him. They continued with the same method.
Twenty homes were completely evacuated of their residence and turned into military barracks. More than 100 people were arrested from all neighborhoods of the town of Tammun, and methods of physical and psychological torture were used against them. They were left for long hours in the freezing cold without care or attention.
They brought me into a room. One of them took a hookah pipe and hit me on the head with it. Then they threw me on the floor and started beating me with metal rods, iron pieces, glass, and anything they could find. One of them even lifted a couch and hit me with it. They used every possible method of beating.
The U.S. has been escalating pressure against Venezuela in recent months under the pretext of fighting drug trafficking. It's launched airstrikes on boats in the Caribbean and South Pacific, deployed warships possibly in preparation for military action. Camila Escalante has traveled to an eastern Venezuelan state for this report.
Venezuela has been the subject of intense media attention in recent months as the United States doubles down on its pressure aimed at overthrowing the government in Caracas. In the eastern state of Anzoátegui, an assembly of local leadership meets as part of a process to fortify the United Socialist Party, the PSUV, from the grassroots level.
What the Venezuelans want is peace, prosperity, and we have our own democratic system. We have elections. We are even electing at this moment communities and popular power all over the country.
Venezuela held another election on Sunday to vote on local projects at the communal level, which will be funded by the state. And while the spectacle continues on social media, daily routines seem unaffected.
Things are happening. People are going to the beaches. People are going to party. People are working, are studying. But we are also getting ready for any scenario. If the imperialism of the USA tries to attack Venezuela, we'll know how to answer, and we will prevail. Venezuelans, the only thing we want is to be respected, and for the world and for the great powers to respect our sovereignty, to respect our people and our self-determination.
Throughout the country, daily life continues for Venezuelans against the backdrop of the incessant campaign of aggression leveled by the United States against the country as the massive military buildup escalates in the Caribbean Sea.
Governor of Anzoátegui, Luis José Mercado, says while calm reigns, Venezuelans are prepared to defend their nation.
In our state of Anzoátegui, which is part of the Caribbean coastal region of our country, we have entered a period of permanent mobilization. What we have done for these past 3 months or more is carry out intense activity involving military, police, and popular mobilizations. Each of our 205 community circuits has an organization with militia units that have been mobilizing, holding night marches and meetings, conducting training exercises, and carrying out military-style preparations. In Venezuela, the majority of us, the women and men of this nation, are absolutely determined to preserve our independence and our sovereignty.
Venezuela is a country at peace, advancing in its various transformative projects, strengthening its economy in the face of the economic blockade, and guarding its sovereignty. Camila Escalante, Anzoátegui.
European aerospace company Airbus has just ordered urgent recall of over 6,000 A320 family aircraft after mid-air incident exposed serious software flaw in flight control systems. European Union Aviation Safety Agency directed airlines to revert to earlier software before flights can resume. Now, this recall is among the largest in Airbus history. It affects more than half the global A320 fleet, causing widespread cancellations and delays. Move follows an October flight from Mexico to the U.S. that experienced a sudden altitude drop, injuring 15 passengers. And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. In the name of Allah, dear brother and sister, salam. You're listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, and in this episode, we're going to speak about the impact of social media on human interactions. But first, as the ritual of this program, we'll look at the calendar. What date is today? Today is Saturday, 8th of Jamadil Thani, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 8th of the month of Azar, 1404 of the solar calendar, and the 29th of November, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. So this is verse 11 of chapter Al-Mujadilah. And as you know, in every episode of today's special, we listen to one or two verses of the Holy Quran, and then we focus on the meaning and the important point of that verse or verses. So again, chapter Al-Mujadilah, verse 11 for today.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu idha qila lakum tafassahu fil majalisi fafsahu yafsahillahu lakum wa idha qila shuzu fanshuzu yarfa'illahu alladhina amanu minkum walladhina utul 'ilma darajat. Wallahu bima ta'maluna khabir.
O you who have believed, when you are told, space yourselves in assemblies, then make space, Allah will make space for you. And when you are told, arise, then arise, Allah will raise those who have believed among you, and those who were given knowledge by degrees, and Allah is acquainted with what you do.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The blessed verse is saying that if believers act upon the same, will grant you spacious abodes in paradise and better provisions, sustenance, and a nobler heart in this world. It is worthy of note that many a delicacy of moral questions and social life of Muslims are treated in the Holy Quran, which is the constitutional law of Muslims, where such delicate points are also mentioned amongst fundamental injunctions, such that Muslims bear in mind that following general rules is sufficient for them. Those who act upon such precepts will be rewarded by Allah Almighty in this world. Allah.
Okay. The topic of this episode of today's special is the impact of social media on human interactions. Social media has had an astounding effect on human interaction in both a positive and negative light. This effect has grown exponentially with the rapid development of new technologies and communication platforms. It's clear to see that the way people communicate in these modern times is changing on a daily basis. The development of these technologies has given birth to concerns that time spent on social media platforms is taking away from face-to-face communication, and this is known as social displacement.
It's no secret that social media has changed the way we interact with each other. But just how much has it changed our communication styles? Let's find out. First, let's talk about the sheer amount of time we spend on social media. According to a recent study, the average person spends about 2 hours and 24 minutes per day on social media platforms. That's over 16 hours per week and nearly 35 days per year. As a result, many of us have become more comfortable with communicating online than in person. One of the most significant ways social media has changed communication is the rise of abbreviations and acronyms. It's become common to use shorthand such as LOL, Laugh Out Loud, and BRB, Be Right Back, in online conversations. These abbreviations have also leaked into our in-person conversations, with many people using them without even realizing it. Another way social media has impacted communication is by changing the way we express emotions. In the past, we relied on verbal cues and facial expressions to communicate how we were feeling. However, with the rise of emojis, we now have an entire library of symbols to convey our emotions through text. In fact, over 5 billion emojis are sent every day on Facebook Messenger alone. Social media has also given rise to a new phenomenon called ghosting. This is when someone suddenly stops responding to messages or calls, leaving the other person in the dark about what's going on. According to a study, 25% of adults have ghosted someone, with 20% admitting to doing it because they were too anxious to have a difficult conversation.
Special topics for a special program. You can listen today, now and here, IRIB English Radio. Today's special.
In discussion on online interactions, we focus on neurobiological effects. As debates continue over social media's benefits and risks, researchers are delving deeper into the neurobiological and psychological effects of online interactions. One challenge is assessing social media's impact is its rapid evolution, which complicates efforts to conduct long-term studies that link digital use to specific cognitive or behavioral changes. While some experts argue that digital technologies are fundamentally rewriting children's brain and contributing to a mental health crisis, others contend that the evidence for such claims remains inconclusive. Now that our discussion is about social media. Let's look at do's and don'ts of social media. Do keep your private. So you've been hitting the gym, you're looking great, and you're tempted to show off your body in a private pic to a mate. But would you be okay if the picture fell into the wrong hands? While your motives might be innocent, once your picture is out there, it could be tricky to get it back. Even over private message or Snapchat, posts can be saved, kept, and shared forever. So put your camera down and save it for the physical world. The other point, engaging in social skill-building activities. Participating in activities that require real-time social interaction can help you maintain and improve your social skills. Group sports, volunteer work, social clubs, and community events are all excellent opportunities to practice communication, teamwork, and empathy in a real-world setting.
While social media has made communication more convenient, it's also had some negative effects. One of these is the rise of cyberbullying. In fact, nearly 34% of students have experienced cyberbullying at some point, with 16% of those cases being severe. Cyberbullying can have serious consequences on a person's mental health and well-being. Another downside of social media is the echo chamber effect. This is when people surround themselves with like-minded individuals and consume content that reinforces their existing beliefs. This can lead to a lack of exposure to opposing viewpoints, which can hinder healthy debate and dialogue. But it's not all negative. Social media has also opened up a world of opportunities for communication and collaboration. For example, businesses can now easily connect with customers and get real-time feedback. Additionally, social media has been instrumental in organizing and spreading awareness about social justice movements. Lastly, social media has also impacted the way we consume news and information. With the rise of fake news and clickbait headlines, it's more important than ever to be critical of the information we see online. According to a study, 64% of adults believe that fake news is causing confusion about basic facts and current events. There you have it, a deep dive into how social media has changed the way we communicate. While there are certainly negative aspects to it, there are also many positive effects. It's up to us to be responsible and mindful of how we use social media in our daily lives.
That was a very essential and interesting topic. So inshallah, we'll continue during these days. Tomorrow, be with us with the same topic. Thank you for listening. That was today's special from IRIB English Radio. And till then, fi amanillah.
So far from Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
There are activists who do not just challenge systems, they confront them head on. They blur the lines between protest and provocation, pushing public discourse into uncomfortable but necessary territory. Their work is often polarizing, but it's rooted in a deep conviction to dismantle injustice. My guest today is one such activist. Welcome to SORP. I am Bahman Roy.
Calla Walsh is an American political activist, writer and organizer known for her outspoken views on US foreign policy, anti-imperialism and Palestinian solidarity. She is a member of the Democratic Socialists of America and co-chair of the National Network on Cuba. Walsh has contributed to different media outlets and has participated in delegations to Cuba and Syria. In 2023, she was arrested during direct actions targeting Elbit Systems, an Israeli military contractor, as part of a work with Palestine Action US.
Calla Walsh, it's a pleasure to have you on SORP.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. I know you must be very tired, but let me just get to the first question. We'll take it from there. What first sparked your interest in activism and political organizing?
I think the first issue that really sparked my interest was the climate crisis, and I quickly realized that we cannot stop the climate crisis without stopping imperialism, and that imperialism is the greatest destroyer of the environment in the world. And I think at first, as a kid in the United States, we aren't taught to care about any country except ourselves. But as my process of getting involved politically developed, I realized the necessity of fighting against US-led imperialism.
Right. And were there formative experiences growing up that shaped your worldview?
Well, I was 12 years old when Donald Trump was elected. And certainly I don't think Donald Trump is an aberration in the long, long history of fascist, genocidal, racist U.S. presidents, but there was a huge spark of political activity and protest and momentum in that moment, and I got involved at a very young age in different movements, whether it was the Women's March, the March for Our Lives against gun violence, and later the 2020 protests against police violence and racism and brutality, and I was involved in many different ways of protesting, of organizing, and as I know we're going to talk about, one of those very formative experiences was working on campaigns and really trying to work within the system like we are told to, and trying to use all these legal means to make change, and realizing over time that politicians don't work for the people, they work for weapons companies and oil companies, and that we need to use other tactics and strategies to make change.
Right. I'm just curious. You were a 12-year-old lady when Donald Trump came into office for the very, very first time. So that's such a young age. How would such a young girl get interested even in the politics of these things? You know, what familial background helped you shape that sort of worldview?
Well, I grew up in the United States, but my family is Irish-American.
Uh-huh.
I've never been to Ireland. My family and my extended family, we aren't very connected to our Irish heritage or background. But once I started to learn about settler colonialism in the U.S. and how this entire American identity, just like the Israeli settler Zionist identity, is a genocidal construct that is built upon the blood of the indigenous peoples of North America, just like the Zionist entity is built upon the blood of the Palestinian people.
Right.
And so connecting to where I'm truly from, where my family is truly from, and learning the fierce, militant history of resistance in Ireland to colonialism, to imperialism, and in solidarity with the Palestinian cause, I think gave me a much, much deeper understanding of what struggle means.
Of course.
That it's something that my people have been partaking in for 800 years against colonialism.
So this must have also been kind of a trigger for you to go and study the heritage and the background and what happened with the Irish cause.
That's
very interesting, of course. How did your early involvement in climate justice evolve into broader anti-imperialist work?
Like I said, I was part of a lot of climate organizing, of youth groups such as the Youth Climate Strike, and most of our actions were focused on asking politicians to change their policy. I participated in protests outside the White House, in the halls of Congress, begging our elected officials to listen to us to protect our future. And what I realized is that, asking politely the people in power to, make change that actually works against their own interests when these politicians' campaigns are funded by, all these corporations. And even many of the politicians who claim to be pro green energy, pro sustainability, such as Ed Markey, who I believe we're going to discuss in a bit. Many of them, talk this talk, but in reality, they support the U.S. military, which is the greatest polluter on planet Earth and has caused more environmental destruction and pollution than any other entity on planet Earth. And so, what I realized is that imperialism is the primary contradiction in the world today, and that is what we need to focus our struggle on, because it encompasses every single issue. We can't have climate justice, we can't have women's rights, we can't have fair housing and any of the things we want to see while we live in a system of global exploitation and constant war and genocide, which is what the U.S. and Zionist and NATO empire feed off of.
Right. Now I'm going to talk about a little bit about the digital organizing and the youth movements that you were part of. What was it like helping build the Markeyverse and mobilizing Gen Z voters? Tell me about that.
First, let me just say it's crazy to hear that term said on Iranian TV, but that was a big effort.
I did my own work.
It was a big effort that I was involved in. I guess flash forward a couple years after I got involved politically, the COVID pandemic hit. I was 15. I was a sophomore in high school, and suddenly I was stuck at home and locked inside. And so all of the organizing that I was doing shifted to the digital sphere. Yeah. And a lot of adults and folks, working in political organizations and campaigns didn't know how to use the tools of social media to mobilize young people in the way that young people who are just fluent in these platforms do. And we innovated really creative techniques to turn out young voters. And we really emphasized, the candidate that we were supporting, Ed Markey, his stance on the Green New Deal, on progressive legislation that we supported. But in retrospect, a lot of that legislation, it was simply to improve the lives of people living in the U.S. And that is predicated upon the continuation of the, you know, exploitation of the global south, the continuation of these wars and these genocides. And I still learned a lot from those experiences. You know, I've arrived at the politics I have today by trying all these different tactics and strategies and realizing, you know, what is futile versus what actually poses a threat to the ruling class and to our oppressors.
Right. And how do you see digital activism changing the landscape of political engagement?
To borrow a phrase from Fidel Castro, I think the battle of ideas is being waged on social media. And so we cannot write off the digital sphere. We cannot write off these platforms as important battlegrounds for us to wage ideological struggle, to counter imperialist propaganda. If we look at how, you know, the CIA and various imperialist agencies' investments and strategies and budgets have shifted over the past decades, increasingly so much is being invested on propagandizing through the digital sphere. You know, I think some really good examples are the regime change attempts in Cuba and in Iran, which attempt to portray themselves as, you know, organic, homegrown protest movements, but in reality are usually hashtags that were created in Washington, D.C. or Langley, Virginia. And that's why I'm so honored to be here, because what I do have is a platform where I can, you know, share the reality that I'm seeing. And while I don't claim to be an expert on anything, really, I do think that, you know, having young people from the United States see this reality and see, you know, the destruction of that is caused by the U.S. Zionist aggression, and to bring back those lessons to people in the U.S. To understand is absolutely essential.
Well, you know, Carla, we are living in a world with mainstream media having the final say in many, many of the events that we are surrounded by. How do you make yourself heard by the people around you while they are also all being bombarded by these mainstream media regarding the truth that you have uncovered?
I think that's another, you know, change that's been caused by the shift to digital platforms and social media is, although mainstream media is dominant in many ways, social media kind of democratizes how we receive news. And so regular people, yes, despite, you know, not working for the BBC or CNN or MSNBC, we can create a platform for ourselves. And I think often that is so much more compelling to our audience and to people who want to understand what is happening in the world, because frankly, mainstream media is very dishonest. And I think the average person is smart enough to realize that and to be disillusioned with it. And the fact is they ignore, you know, the vast majority of what is actually happening in the world. And so to create our own platforms and to elevate our own voices, and to speak the truth and without fear of being critical of power and of capital and of the imperialist ruling class is a great task, but I think it is one that we are seeing great progress on, and that consciousness is greatly shifting, yeah, especially among young people, and that is why the U.S. is trying to crack down on platforms like TikTok. That is why there is so much increasing censorship on platforms like Meta. I, of course, have been suspended many times on these platforms, but nevertheless, we have to continue to get our word out there, and we also need to be creative with how we disseminate ideas, because, yeah, increasingly, the censorship is only going to get worse, and we can't only be reliant on, you know, platforms that are controlled by our enemy.
Tell me something. I think within the American scene and the issue of censorship, I think it's getting harder and harder to get a message across. Do you think it's always been like that, or it has become visibly worse? Which one do you think it is?
I think it's both. You know, I think freedom of speech has always been a lie. It's, uh-huh, freedom of speech for those who the government feels
almost
like it.
Almost everywhere.
Yes, but I do think we've seen some qualitative escalations and crackdowns in both the U.S. and in the so-called United Kingdom and in Europe. I would point to, you know, the prescription of Palestine Action in the U.K. Right. as a really extreme example. And, you know, our comrades there, they can't even say the words Palestine Action without potentially being charged with terrorism. And in the United States, you know, it's not quite there yet, but we are seeing so many people being fired from their workplaces, being kicked out of their universities for mere anti-Zionist speech. You know, the sacrifice of losing a job or losing a degree is minuscule compared to what Palestinians are sacrificing, compared to what Iranians are sacrificing, compared to what, you know, the people in the entire global South, and especially the Axis of Resistance countries, are experiencing under U.S. Zionist imperialism. And so, in my view, the best way to respond to the censorship is to double down and to be louder than ever, because the louder that we are, the harder it is for them to silence us. And they actually can't possibly, you know, repress us all if we are all speaking out in support of the Palestinian resistance. And so while I expect for there to be more, for there to be more lawfare, for there to be more attempts to crush free speech, nevertheless, I think we have to, you know, double down on our pro-resistance speech. And you know, I wanna shout out especially the organization Sami Dune, which was designated in Canada and the U.S., and there were restrictions placed on it because they support the Palestinian resistance and because they fight for the right. freedom of Palestinian prisoners. And there was a lot of fear that was instilled in people in the movement that if they even say, you know, I stand by Sami Nun because of this, during this, you know, phony designation, there's a lot of fear that that could, you know, even lead to people being targeted. But if we all stand together and if we all, you know, stand in solidarity with people facing repression, it is impossible for them to be isolated. So, yes, I think it's important to use these moments of the intensified repression to build more unity in our principles right. of resistance and steadfastness.
Right. And after working on, well, of course, you worked on Senator Markey's campaign. What led you to your disenchantment with electoral politics?
I'd certainly been, you know, slowly getting disenchanted over time. I think my values and my principles were always far more radical than what could be expressed in an electoral campaign. But right. those were the opportunities that I found to get involved in change. And I realized, especially after taking part in protests in 2020, and then especially after what happened in Palestine in May 2021, right. the evictions in Sheikh Jarrah, the Six-Day War, and the bombardment of Gaza, that woke me up to the reality of imperialism and of the Zionist genocide against Palestine. And what I can only understand is my own complicity in that up until the moment that I broke with the U.S. states and working within the Democratic Party. Because the Democratic Party is, you know, just as genocidal and imperialist as the Republican Party. They just have different tactics and strategies through which they hold on to power. And like I said, I, you know, had worked for the senator, I'd worked for many politicians, and just seeing, you know, how horrific the bombardment was, and also how heroic the Palestinian response, the response of the resistance in Gaza was, firing back at the Zionist entity, I realized it was a moment where I had to make a choice that would define the trajectory for the rest of my life, which was to split with this liberal, reformist, social imperialist part of the, you know, movement that I was in, and to self-criticize, to use that as an opportunity to bring more people over to being pro-Palestine, to being anti-Zionist. We started a pressure campaign on the senator to try to get him to change his stance. And the failure of that to get him to change his stance also made me realize that even though that was someone I'd worked for and invested my labor in and helped him win the election, that my voice made no difference compared to checks from AIPAC or checks from Zionist donors or from weapons companies or his investment in U.S. interests. And so after that, I became much more involved in the pro-Palestine movement, and I basically completely left electoral politics, and from there on out spoke very vocally about how I feel like electoralism is ultimately, you know, counterinsurgent, and that we need to make a firm, clean break and to work outside of these institutions to, you know, create something new, to build an alternative to empire.
Right. And of course, you were involved with politics for a while. Did you find different voices? Like, for example, what we hear from Senator Bernie Sanders. Did you see that sort of voices often within the politics, within the mechanics and the machination of the mechanics of politics in the U.S.? Such voices, are they just rare, or there are still more than just one person in there thinking the way he does?
I think that I see, you know, I see Bernie Sanders, I see Ed Markey, I see AOC and the Squad. Even, you know, Zohran Mamdani, who just won this election in New York. I still see this progressive, or someone call like Democratic Socialist wing of the Democratic Party. I see it as a concerted effort to try to bring young people back into the Democratic Party because they have lost so much support because of Palestine. Because young people saw the Democratic Party carry out a Holocaust for 2 years, live-streamed before our own eyes. No wonder people aren't coming out and weren't voting for Kamala Harris. And I think the Democrats realize that, and they realize they need younger, more progressive people who will say Free Palestine as a slogan to try to get people back into voting them and working in the party. But these people are not anti-Zionist. They're not anti-imperialist. They constantly defend Israel's right to exist. They constantly condemn the Palestinian resistance and the entire axis of resistance. They constantly promote, you know, regime change and sanctions against Iran. And so I think while it's positive to heighten the contradictions within within Congress, within the Democratic Party, within the U.S. government, electing these politicians is not a means to an end, and we have to be very, very careful with, you know, how working within these institutions might force us to compromise our principles. And so that's why I'm very openly critical of them.
Right, I see. And do you believe progressive candidates can still drive meaningful change within the system?
I think at the local level, that argument could be made, but I think, as I just argued, you know, I think fundamentally,
Kind of got my answer.
Yeah, it's I see it as, you know, a part of like the counterinsurgency, and I think when we have these huge ruptures and shifts of consciousness, like after the Al-Aqsa flood, there is a huge burst of, you know, anti-imperialist consciousness in the United States. And I think one of the responses by the Zionists, by the imperialists, by the ruling class, is to try to capture that energy and to funnel it into something that is fundamentally not challenging or threatening to U.S. empire. And so they would much rather have us be working on a campaign than, say, doing direct action against a weapons company.
Carla Walsh, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Course, and thank you for being with us on another soap. Thank you so much, and goodbye until next time.